Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, opponents are calling it a book ban. We'll discuss a new library book policy at the Central Bucks School District and the crisis facing animal shelters. Many are overwhelmed by the number of pets being surrendered and the lack of available homes. But to start, we have a look at the new Sixers Arena proposed for Center City, Philadelphia. It is far from a done deal, but the arena, which would hold at least 18,000 fans, is generating heated reactions. Action both pro and con. If it's approved, 76th Place would eventually occupy a full city block between 10th and 11th Streets on Market and cost nearly $1.5 billion with no public funding involved. Supporters say it would boost the renaissance of Center City. However, the arena would also be located just a few steps from Philadelphia's Chinatown neighborhood, and many who live there say it could destroy the community's identity. So what's next in the 76th Place story? WHYY's Aaron Moselle and Sophia Schmidt have been reporting on the arena proposal for Plan Philly, and they join us in studio with more. Hi, Sophia.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, and how are you, Aaron?
I'm good. How are you?
Just fine, thanks. So, Aaron, to you first. The 76ers have been shopping for a new arena location for a while and most recently were turned down for a site along the Delaware Riverfront at Penn's Landing. Why are managing partners Josh Harris and David Blitzer now focusing on 10th and Market? What's the appeal?
There's a few reasons. I think, as you said, it's going to occupy a block between 10th and 11th Streets. Along Market Street. This is a very centrally located location. Location, as we're talking about real estate here. So at least on paper, you have an arena that's very easy to access for fans, particularly if you consider all of the public transportation options you have there, bus, train, not trolley, but we do have two major subway lines that run underneath. So
sure.
The hope is that a lot of fans can get there easily and that they'll want to go often because of that. You're also talking about what they've wanted for a while, as you said, a brand new arena. The Wells Fargo Center, where the Sixers play right now, is already more than a couple decades old. That's around the average for the NBA in terms of how old their stadiums are. And so the prospect of having a brand new stadium and a centrally located plot in Philadelphia seems like a win-win to them. They can control things team-wise, like their schedule. They don't, because they currently share the Wells Fargo with the Flyers, and that creates all kinds of issues there. And they also just seem to like this trend of putting arenas downtown. Other teams have done it. They feel successfully. Obviously, the prime example here is Madison Square Garden, but we've also seen Chicago do it and a couple other teams do it as well.
Yeah. Back to transportation for just a moment. Right now, you know, many Sixers fans drive to the Wells Fargo Center in South Philly for games. If 76th Place is eventually built at 10th and Market, you know, you were talking about public transportation, Aaron. Have you heard anything about proposals, plans to build more parking space?
Not yet. It's a big open question in terms of what they will do for people who want to drive, particularly if I'm thinking about Sixers fans who live over the bridge in South Jersey who want to come over. I don't see them potentially hopping on Patco necessarily, if particularly for a night game, which a lot of these are during the season. But, you know, if you talk to SEPTA, they say, this is great. You know,
I'm sure.
Everyone's going to be riding the Market L till 11th Street, or they're going to get off at the Broad Street line at City Hall, or they're going to ride the bus, or they're going to, you know, folks from the suburbs are going to come in on regional rail right there at Jefferson Station and just flood into the station. You know, parking's a big question. There are a lot of parking lots that exist, you know, municipal and otherwise, in and around this arena, but in terms of sort of a centrally located, massive parking lot like we see at the Wells Fargo. I haven't seen anything like that yet, so it does create some questions about traffic and congestion on game nights.
Yeah. City officials, for the most part, thumbs up, Aaron?
Thumbs up for now. Very optimistic, very excited about the prospect of finally having something that can be a true economic engine for this area, which has struggled for decades to really find a foothold, despite millions of dollars being invested by all kinds of developers. Most recently, we had the Fashion District, a $300 million project that unfortunately opened in 2019 right before the pandemic and really has not been able to have the impact that the developers there had hoped. And so part of the idea here is to have something that can work for this area that has not had the success that the west side of Market has had for years.
Yeah, and some of this Fashion District would be preserved should the arena actually go up.
That's right. The Fashion District runs roughly from 9th to 12th Street.
Okay.
So we're talking about a third, roughly, of their footprint would be gone as a result of this arena.
So, Sophia, to you, the biggest negative impact, again, likely will be on Philadelphia's Chinatown community. What are you hearing from Asian American leaders in the city?
Concerns about traffic, about parking, about the impact that years of construction could have on residents and businesses, many of them small businesses, family owned. Asian Americans United is a nonprofit based in Chinatown, and they came out against the plan pretty quickly. Their engagement, civic engagement director, Wei Chen, sent out a statement right after the announcement saying that there was a coalition already forming to, you know, quote, protect our community against this project. Leaders of the Philadelphia Chinatown Development Corporation came out a little bit more moderate. I talked to their director, John Chin, who told me that, after this announcement, he didn't really have enough information to support or oppose it, but he definitely has some concerns.
Yeah. And yet he also did, Sophia, reference what had happened in Washington, D.C. The Capital One Arena was built right next to D.C.'s Chinatown, I think it was in 1997, and there were many concerns that this would negatively impact D.C.'s Chinatown, and it did. Tell us more about that. Apparently did, I should say.
Right. So it's kind of credited as contributing to the decline of D.C.'s Chinatown. Like you said, it was built in 1997. WAMU in D.C. has reported that since then, real estate prices in the neighborhood have skyrocketed. Most of the Chinese residents and businesses that were there when the arena opened have since left. They had, you know, a stat that in 2010, there were 3,000 Chinese residents in the neighborhood. Just a few years ago, that number had dropped to just 300. And so, like you said, the biggest fear basically in Philly is, you know, we don't want that to happen here.
What is the Sixers development team, Sophia, promising Chinatown?
Yeah, so they say that they, you know, are aware of these concerns and that they would negotiate some kind of community benefits agreement with surrounding communities. So a CBA is, usually a binding contract between a developer and, like, civic groups or community groups. This development team has said that they would negotiate something that could include elements like supporting local businesses, workforce participation, affordability, neighborhood preservation, and access to the arena.
And what are community leaders saying about this?
Well, I talked to two people, and, you know, John Chin of PCDC basically said his biggest priority for a CBA would be affordable housing in the community because, you know, concerns about gentrification in Chinatown have been, you know, preceding this announcement, but this does not help. I think that's one of the biggest concerns here. I also talked to Toy Nguyen of the Southeast Asian Mutual Assistance Association's Coalition. That organization is actually based in South Philly, but he is extremely concerned about this project, says that his organization will put all of its effort into opposing it. He said a successful CBA would have to be $10 to $20 million a year, stuff like education, community wellness. Short of that, he said, he used a stronger word, but basically short of that, it would be baloney.
All right, we've got some calls and comments coming in. Email from Beverly, who says traffic is horribly backed up on I-95 and the Schuylkill Expressway, among other routes, when there are games. An arena in downtown Philadelphia is a terrible idea. And then we have a question from Dave, and I think, Aaron, you might have addressed this already. Why do Sixers want to move to a new arena? Again, they've been looking for a while, and there might be some real positives in terms of being able to manage their own schedule and et cetera.
Right, and they have what it looks like right now, a willing developer in the current company that runs the Fashion District. As we've said, they have not lived up to their own expectations, and so the idea of the Sixers knocking on their door and saying, hey, you want to give us some of your real estate so we can put in this arena, probably sounds pretty appealing at this point, and they have expressed early support. So they have a location that is sort of ready-made for them to slip into, although that slipping, I should say, will take some time. If this all goes as planned, it will take, you know, a decade for the Sixers to actually be playing there. So this is a long-term project.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the timeline. What is next in the process of trying to secure approval?
So the immediate step is to talk to some of these neighbors that Sophia has been discussing, because, you know, this project will invariably need zoning, and it's a lot easier to get zoning approval if you have widespread community support. So there's going to be a lot of public meetings and a lot of public negotiations and discussions about, you know, what this project will first look like, but also, you know, what kind of impacts it will have on the neighborhood. Yeah. How do we mitigate those best? How can we all come together and be okay with this project, basically?
Are we talking about a couple years here?
At least.
For the initial steps and the, you know, listening to what people have to say part of the process?
Yeah, I would say a couple of, you know, years straight. And then, but, you know, that process is going to, you know, those conversations are likely going to happen throughout this process. Yeah. It's going to be a very active and organic conversation. And it's not going to be easy. It's going to take a lot of patience. And there will probably be multiple meetings with some of the groups that Sophia mentioned to kind of get this done. And even then, you know, if the community is really committed to opposing this, it's going to present a problem for the developers, because it may influence, for example, the city council person who isn't, you know, represents this district, mm-hmm. who may, you know, not want to support personally a project that his constituents are not interested in. In this case, we're talking about Mark Squilla.
And initially, he seemed to be in favor.
He is. Yeah. But the caveat that he and all other, you know, city and public officials is, as long as, you know, this is okay with the community, yeah. we've got to make sure that the community is on board, you know, that, yes, this is could be really great for the area, could bring tons of money into this area. But if the community is not into it, I may not be into it.
Okay, so say the community does buy in eventually, and there is final approval. What is the timeline for demolition and construction and eventual opening look like?
So opening, it's supposed to be 2031, which coincides with the end of their lease at the, yep. Wells Fargo Center. That's no accident. In terms of the community conversations, we've talked about a couple years, and then in intervening years, we would see, you know, construction. That's the bulk of this timeline.
Okay. Interesting, Aaron, you know, the Market East Corridor was at one time a real destination point for shoppers. Give us a little bit of that, a sense of that history.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, first half of the 20th century, this was a premier shopping destination in Philadelphia. You had at one time 8 different department stores. You know, people will remember Wanamaker's and Strawbridge and Clothier. You know, among that group, it was really a place to be. And, you know, that sort of those glory days faded eventually, as they often do. And it's really been since the 1970s that this corridor has, I don't necessarily want to use the word languish, but it's struggled.
Challenged.
Yeah. You know, to have the foot traffic that people would want.
Well, we'll see what happens. The story will continue to unfold for quite a while, and I'm sure you, Aaron Roselle, and Yusuf Via Schmidt will be on it for us here at WHYY. Thank you so much for joining us in studio, and I'm sure we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
All right. Up next on the Regional Roundup, we talk about a controversial library book policy at the Central Bucks School District. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The Central Bucks School District has implemented a library book policy, which has drawn impassioned protest from many members of the Central Bucks community. The policy takes aim at what proponents call unnecessary sexualized content in library books available to elementary, middle, and high schoolers, and would supervise the process of selection or rejection of literature intended for the district's library shelves. The school board, which is Republican majority, voted overwhelmingly in favor, 6-3 Tuesday night, but an emotional crowd, which gathered outside the district building in Doylestown, expressed growing concerns about censorship and the potential exclusion of books of value to the LGBTQ community or those which address race and racism. Some library professionals say the policy is tantamount to a book ban, and the ACLU is watching closely as well. WHYY Suburban reporter Emily Rizzo has been following the story for us and is here with us in studio. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Mary.
So the policy's goal is to scrutinize what's called sexualized content in new library books and other materials before those books and et cetera are made available to students. Emily, what is the definition of sexualized content according to the school board?
Good question. The district does not clearly define what sexualized content is. There's a section that describes inappropriate and sexualized content, and it uses vague phrases like implied nudity and visually implied depictions of sexual acts. Teachers, librarians, parents are all confused about what these terms mean, and district officials have not clarified. The ACLU has pointed out a few major issues with vague criteria like this, and here's one. It can create a chilling effect. So it may cause librarians to self-censor. So the policy is so vague that it may paralyze the entire book selection process. So librarians have no idea which books they can or can't recommend because we don't know what sexualized content means.
So who eventually will define this? Is it the board? I understand they might also be forming a special committee. I mean, tell us about that, Emily.
I'm not sure we'll ever see clear definitions of these criteria. And I think part of that, the ACLU says that's kind of the point, right? Because it gives the decision makers a lot of power to just use those policies and those criteria in the way that they want to. But what's next here is the district officials will start writing this thing called an administrative regulation, which will lay out more details that the policy is currently missing. But we don't know what it will include.
At this point, some are calling it a book ban. Who takes this view? What is the response of the board and Superintendent Abram Lookabot to this determination that it might be book ban?
Yeah, I mean, ACLU, Education Law Center, they all say this is laying the ground for unconstitutional censorship. The board officials say this isn't a book ban. They say the community is misinterpreting the policy. The superintendent frames the policy as prioritizing age-appropriate content, that's a quote, and creating processes for acquiring new books. They say they are also giving parents an avenue to challenge a book they don't want their kids to read. When a book is challenged, though, it could be removed from libraries. But some say the district is kind of misleading the public because the policy is not just for parents. It says any district resident can challenge a book, and it wouldn't just remove the book for one kid. It would remove the book for everyone in that age group. And when the superintendent told me that this isn't a book ban, I said, okay, so what does a book ban look like? Hmm. And he said he didn't want to speculate.
Well, there has been some concern, Emily, that this will largely negatively impact kids in the LGBTQ community. What are your thoughts here?
Right. I mean, you know, we're hearing people say removing books of this kind sends a message to LGBTQ kids that they're not welcome. And this fear that it will impact LGBTQ-related content is partly rooted in this fear around this site called Woke Pennsylvania. It's this anonymous site that was created that lists books in Central Bucks libraries that they describe as inappropriate and sexually explicit. And many of those books are LGBTQ-related content. It warns of left-wing indoctrination in the classroom. And there was this board meeting in March where parents read excerpts from books on that site. So many parents and students fear that those are the same books that will be targeted in Central Bucks libraries.
Let's talk for a moment about the board itself. It's been Republican majority for a while, but after the elections last year, there were a couple of members are associated with some far right groups. One of the new school board members, Republican Deborah Cannon, has been a vocal member of the group Moms for Liberty, Bucks County, PA, which As you report, Emily's a national group that fights for book censorship. Canon was endorsed in the 2021 election by the right-wing, a Proud American Patriots Network. And my understanding is she had talked about grooming, which is a word that we've been hearing a lot of lately, at a school board meeting last year before she won election to the board. Let's take a listen.
Right now, as we speak, there are demonic adults recruiting, brainwashing, and participating in unconscionable behaviors with children, and every one of you know it. There are parents who are fooled and parents who will protect. I know which parent I am.
So there are two members, including Deborah Cannon, who belong to Moms for Liberty Bucks County, now on the school board. You know, the Central Bucks District is fairly diverse. Surprising that, you know, the election went this way?
Yes. Previously, the board has been Republican-dominated, but I think many parents are surprised that a person with these extreme views made it to the board. But I will say it's important to note that Cannon's campaign was also funded, along with the other Republican members, by Paul Martino, who donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to school board candidates across Pennsylvania. So there were powerful people behind Cannon. So surprising, not so much.
Getting lots of comments here. Tweet from BJ, I substitute teach at Central Bucks. The only time students use the library is when they have a project to do or have a class with the librarian. They are more likely to pick up a phone. Tweet from Stephen, they say they're not banning books. It's a bonfire. And then an email from Susan who says, I'd like to hear more about death threats sent to one of the school directors. I believe he resigned because he was worried about his family. And again, there's this tone and this tenor, almost of anger and fear, which has really, as we know, been sitting around elections for the past couple of years. And the Central Bucks School District is not immune.
Definitely not immune. There's so much fear. Teachers say we're living in a climate of fear right now. And when we're talking about censorship right now, we have to say that teachers are already self-censoring their classroom libraries, right? Like, this is a physical example of what's happening. One teacher told me she removed 300 books from her classroom library, and she wasn't alone in that building, that a lot of teachers filtered out half of their libraries. That's what's happening in Central Bucks right now.
And I think also back to the comment from Susan, the person who has no longer a school board member was John Gamble, who received a death threat.
That's
actually
true.
Okay, mm-hmm. Last year. Mm-hmm. Apparently not the only one. So Emily Rizzo, you also spoke to two district librarians, at least two district librarians, but Chris Keehan, Robin Danko. What did they tell you?
Yeah, Keehan, you know, she spoke to the concern that the policy really sows distrust of librarians to know what is appropriate for students. That's really their expertise, their training. She said the policy should be written by librarians. And she fears it's not actually rooted in what's best for kids. It's really about this fight amongst adults. Danko was crying after the board passed the policy. She said normally, when she wants to purchase a new book, she'll get it the same day it comes out. She'll go to the store herself. But now she's worried this review process. So librarians have to submit a list of books to be reviewed. And she's worried that now she'll have to wait a really long time for books to be approved. And really it comes down to it taking a lot longer for kids to get new books in their hands.
Has the superintendent mentioned specific books as examples warranting further scrutiny?
The superintendent has not, to my knowledge. But one board member did mention Lawn Boy during a board meeting. And that's a book that's been targeted nationally. It's a coming-of-age novel about race and sexual identity. There's one copy of this book in one high school library. During this last board meeting, when the policy was passed, three of the board members were still fighting against it. And one said, this policy creates a problem that didn't exist before. Like before now, most kids maybe wouldn't have known that Lawn Boy existed in that one library, except for that one kid who needs it, that one kid who might resonate with that story.
Shakespeare is famous for sexual innuendo. Did the board or superintendent indicate how some classic literature might fare with this policy?
Actually, the policy does say that it won't impact a range of classic literature. But teachers have pointed out to me that that actually reveals some discrimination in the policy, because one teacher literally said to me, you know, why is sex okay if it's old? If sex isn't okay, then why doesn't the policy also impact classic literature? So in the end, we're just not clear on how they will decipher which sexual content is appropriate. And to experts, the policy reads as allowing too much subjectivity there.
So again, this policy is vague. What is your sense as to whether it was written that way for, you know, purposely, really, to keep it vague at this point? Or, you know, why is it vague? I guess it's what I'm asking.
Right. I mean, the ACLU does say that it's intentionally vague because, like, think about this phrase, implied nudity.
What does that mean?
We don't know. And vague terms like that give this unnamed review committee, quote, the ACLU said this, unlimited power and authority to get rid of whatever they don't like.
Email from Megan, who says this harmful policy is written in a way that any taxpayer in our district can challenge any book at any time. If a committee chosen by the school board decides against a book for whatever subjective reasons they may have, the book can be banned for everyone. And again, Emily, I think you did mention that anybody can challenge a book that's being considered. Email from Hannah, excuse me. While students within the district can expect confidentiality from a public library, they cannot in their school library. This policy jeopardizes the concept that minors have a freedom to read and access information. Students need the space to explore information and to know that this freedom is protected in our democracy. And one more comment. Trish says, knowledge is power. Books are the most accessible and inexpensive way to gain knowledge. Taking books away is taking power away. Obviously, this is striking a nerve. You were at the meeting in Doylestown. You were outside. You attended the meeting. You also were with the crowd outside in Doylestown before the meeting began, the school board meeting. What was the sense that you got from that crowd? Largely con, many pro. I mean, what was it, a mix of people, Emily?
Oh, it was about 100 people, mostly, really adamantly against the policy. I'd say maybe 4 people showed up supporting it. And those people also say this isn't a book ban. But yeah, everyone was saying this is censorship and very afraid about what comes next in Central Bucks, very afraid about how this policy will be applied, and specifically about, you know, how it will be used to filter or how it may be used to filter LGBTQ-related content. You know, one expert from the American Library Association told me that nationally, right, we're seeing this trend of that term inappropriate, right? That term inappropriate that shows up in the policy throughout. There's this trend to kind of reframe what is considered inappropriate for minors, to define any references to gender identity or sexual orientation as inherently inappropriate. So these fears that we're seeing from this crowd about this targeting LGBTQ content is rooted in a national pattern.
Another comment from Erlene, who says parents should make decisions about books for their own kids, not make decisions for all family and kids. So, Emily Rizzo, the start of the new school year is just about a month away. How quickly will this policy impact the district's libraries?
We don't know. That may be a detail that we'll see in this document I mentioned called the Administrative Regulation, but we really don't know. We don't know.
There is also some similar concern regarding some actions taken by the Penn Ridge School District. As I understand it, Emily, the school board's policy committee in Penn Ridge will hold a second reading on a new policy tonight about student expression and the dissemination of materials. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I spoke to the ACLU about this, and the legal director told me he's never seen a policy like this in his career.
What does it do?
So it intends to limit any non-school materials disseminated by students. Non-school materials are defined in the policy as any printed, technological, or written materials that are not part of the curriculum or an extracurricular program, including, but not limited to, flyers, invitations, announcements, pamphlets, posters, online discussion areas, and digital bulletin boards. So in a board meeting where the board was talking about this policy, the superintendent said, "Oh, don't worry, this won't impact elementary school's Valentine's invitations. Don't worry. But technically, it may very well so."
That's indeterminate. Well, so is the response from organizations like the ACLU to this?
They're ready. I mean, the ACLU told me that they could even file a suit before the district applies this policy to anything. It's that clearly in violation of the Constitution. So, yeah, I mean, it's just they're just heading in that direction.
Email from Catherine. "My husband and I are considering moving to Bucks County with our infant daughter. This library review process is making us second guess. I grew up in an extremely rural, overwhelmingly white environment with a well-stocked library, and books were how I learned about things that were not discussed in my childhood home. I can't imagine taking this world of knowledge away from my daughter." And Bill asks, "Is there an opportunity to challenge what the committee says?" And this is back to Central Bucks. Have you heard anything about that, Emily?
To challenge in terms of this book review process for new books, I'm not so sure about being able to challenge their decision. And the other thing about it is it doesn't say for how long a book will be removed. So there's a lot of,
a lot of uncertainty.
A lot of uncertainty, yeah.
All right. Story that's developing. Emily Rizzo, our suburban reporter covering Bucks and Montgomery counties for WHYY News. Appreciate you being here. I'm sure we'll hear more from you on this story. And our thanks to all our listeners who commented for this particular interview on the Central Bucks, rather, school district and its new review of incoming library books policy. All right, up next on the regional roundup, we're going to talk about overburdened animal shelters and how we all can help. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. In the space of just 2 years, many animal shelters have gone from experiencing a soaring and heartening number of pet adoptions to crisis mode, overwhelmed by the high number of dogs and cats coming through shelter doors and the lower than usual number of families available to adopt or foster them. The hard truth is some of these pets will be euthanized, even as shelters strive to move away from the practice. There is simply not enough room or care available. The reasons for the huge uptick in pet surrenders are many, but the crushing economic situation is a big one. So what can be done to alleviate the stress on animals, shelters, and families who feel they need to give up their pets? Sarah Barnett is acting co-executive director of the Animal Care and Control Team of Philadelphia, and she's with us for the rest of the hour. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on to talk about this.
Of course. So from January to mid-July, I believe ACT took in over 6,000 animals. Yeah. It's been really challenging finding them homes. And of course, in 2020 and 2021, there was an explosion in pet adoption. What has changed?
I think shelters are finally seeing the negative side of the pandemic that, you know, we were some of the only ones who during the pandemic really benefited from everyone being home. Everyone else, you know, did not. And now what we're seeing is the impact of that. You know, it's a misconception. I think a lot of people think these are pandemic animals, animals that were purchased during the pandemic. And we do see that here and there. But what we're really seeing is people are at a breaking point. Mm-hmm. I think it's because of the economy, probably, because a lot of the reasons we're seeing is, you know, people who really love their animals coming in. We see both. We see people who love their animals. We see some folks who don't seem to care as much. But overwhelmingly, people really seem to care and and want an alternative. And we do have services. We have a help desk that helps provide resources. There's other resources in the community too. But there's only so much that we can do.
Yeah.
And an overwhelming reason that we see is housing related. So it's they're moving, they're being evicted. We had somebody who had three dogs, two are hearing impaired, one is blind. And he had to give all three up because he's homeless now.
That's awful.
We're seeing that a lot. We're seeing people being homeless, becoming homeless, being evicted. And it's extremely hard to find a place to rent with a pit bull type dog or a larger dog and to then pay the pet fees on top of it. So it's a lot for people, and they can't do it.
So ACT Philly is packed right now. Yes. Give us an idea of what you're grappling with. What does it look like at the shelter?
So it's a little bit more difficult for us, I would say, because we, you know, for a long time, we housed over 100 dogs. We had kennels that were meant for one dog, housing two. And in the spring, at the recommendation of national experts, we changed that. We decided each dog should get the space that they're actually supposed to get. The kennel for one dog should be for one dog. And that meant our capacity went down a little bit. You know, we went down from housing 112 dogs, let's say, to what we're housing now, which is in the 80s. And we're doing that really for the welfare of the dogs.
Sure.
But that is difficult because that's doing that at the busiest time of the year is very difficult. And what we're seeing is that the number of animals coming in is really outpacing the rate at which they can leave. We have people who want to help. Everybody wants to help. You know, you ask somebody on the street if they want to help. Of course they do. But no one has space to add an extra dog to their family. No one can foster.
And again, why is that? Because primarily because of economics? Or?
So the ones who, you know, a lot of people who wanted to adopt, they all did it in the pandemic.
Yeah.
You know, we used to see this ebb and flow. Shelters used to really benefit from that very consistent ebb and flow every year. You knew when the adopters increase, you know, when they decrease. The pandemic just threw all that out the window. So part of it is we don't know what to expect. But the other part is that, again, everybody who adopted or fostered, they kind of scratched that itch during the pandemic. And so they're not looking to do it right now. So we really have a shortage of fosters and adopters. And it's not just in Philly. I mean, it's yeah. everywhere across the country. I mean, shelters are really struggling with this and trying to figure out how to best go about it because none of us want to euthanize. But we're at a point.
Yeah.
That, yeah.
I mean, there's a link on your page. It's heartbreaking to dogs, which are time-stamped,
yeah.
which is something you don't want to do. Time-stamped means they have a limited amount of time unless somebody takes them in.
It's extremely hard, yeah. So time stamping is something not all shelters do it. Some will not advertise it. We find that time stamping animals is one of the best ways to get them out in a sense because mm-hmm. people focus on that. But it's heartbreaking because it used to just be for dogs with medical and behavioral concerns, and we've had to start doing it for space, which is we have a dog right now who we've extended, as we call it, I think 4 days now. And he still doesn't have any interest, and he's a good dog. You know, he's a little bit rowdy. His name is Cosmo. He's a good dog. He's just a rowdy 45-pound dog, but nobody's come in to adopt him that would be a good fit. And it's really hard on the staff, and it's really hard on the volunteers, and it's really difficult that we're at this point.
Sometimes animals are surrendered because of behavioral issues, which can be resolved. I mean, you talk about a dog that's rowdy.
Yep.
A dog might just need more exercise.
Right. Well, and sometimes it's actually just in the shelter.
Yeah.
We see plenty of animals who in the shelter, of course, they're rowdy. They're in a kennel. It's
yeah.
stressful. You know,
yes.
they're going to be much more rowdy when they get home. They sleep for 5 hours. So it's, you know, the shelter is not a good example of what the dog will be like at home.
Mm-hmm. What do you offer people, though, who come to the shelter saying, you know, that this dog is, saying, you know, having accidents in the house, I can't deal with this? I mean, do you offer access to training in an effort to keep the animal in the home longer?
Yeah, so what we try to do is we have a help desk. So before surrendering an animal, you actually have to go through our help desk because we really want to make sure that you've been given the resources and that, you know, we can really work with you to try to find a way to have you keep the pet if at all possible. We offer training. We offer sometimes it's vet care. The veterinary shortage is hard enough for people, let alone the costs. So we will sometimes pay for the veterinary care. We've probably spent over $100,000 in the past 7 months keeping people and their pets together.
So, and this is for people who cannot afford the veterinary care their animals need. They otherwise would have turned them in, but now
yeah.
they have vet care, and so they're supported.
Exactly. And those are unexpected vet costs. So that's yeah. we're not talking about vaccines. We're talking about the dog was hit by a car, the dog swallowed a tennis ball, things mm-hmm. like that. Yeah. No one expects to spend, you know, $3,000, and not many people can drop that at the...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, veterinary yeah. care can be really expensive.
Exactly.
And also, too, I mean, this is a moment to maybe take a moment to talk about spaying and neutering, which
yes.
a lot of people cannot, you know, there are a number of animals that are just not spayed and neutered yet, and that, you know, it does contribute to the crowding at shelters.
It's a huge contributing yeah. factor. People, I think, because it's not instant, they don't see the connection, but looking at cats alone, if people were to trap, neuter, and return the cats in their community, we'd have so many less cats, you know, coming in. And it's not a matter of preventing birth. It's a matter of saving lives. So, you know, spaying and neutering your dog, your cat, that's that you have to do it if you want to be a responsible pet owner. And we have resources. There's so many resources. If you can't afford it, we can help you do it.
So as back to the pandemic, you know, kind of we're still in it, obviously, but as the pace of life ratchets up, you know, some people, as you have said, you know, are surrendering animals because they can't find the time, they can't provide the companionship. How do you counsel folks who are in that situation in order to help them keep their animals at home? Because it is hard for most people to give their pets up. It's heartbreaking.
It is. And we, you know, we see a mix. We see folks who are open to that and are open to that counseling. But we also see a lot of people who have also made the resolve already to give them up.
Yeah.
So we really, you know, we try to talk to them. We also give them the reality of the idea of somebody else can give this dog a better home. We explain to them, like, your dog is at risk of euthanasia if it comes in here. Your dog has a great home with you. You might feel guilty because you're not home for dinner, but that dog is happier here than with you than it would be at the shelter. So we really try to explain that to people, but it's not always successful. When it's for those reasons, a lot of times people, by the time they're at the door, they've already come to that.
Yeah. Decision. You also told our producer, Paige, that there's a culture of instant service, people wanting results right now. Yeah, tell us a little bit more about that.
It's very frustrating. It's, you know, people, they want, it's this instant service idea where even for surrendering animals, it's, you know, trying to explain to people, no, we actually want to try to save your dog's life when it comes in or your cat's life. So we'd like to actually schedule it in advance. Things like that. They say no, and they just dump the animal. Mm. They don't want to wait. We had somebody the other night. We said, you have to call this phone number. He had a baby rabbit he was bringing in, and it was after hours. And we said, call that number. It goes to the person behind the window over there because we're closed, and they will come out. And he said, how long does it take? We said, about 10 minutes. He opened the box and put the rabbit on the ground. And a fellow staffer was chasing that rabbit around the parking lot trying to save it. But it's like you couldn't wait 10 minutes, really?
Hey, our act does not pre-screen people who wish to adopt. Instead, you practice what's called open adoption. What are the benefits and the risks here?
So we actually do screen.
Oh, okay.
So open adoption is really more of a catch-all phrase, and different shelters apply it differently. So we do screen. We just do it in a judgment-free way. So what that means is that we don't necessarily have a requirement of you have to own your home and have a yard to have a dog. It's more about figuring out what does that dog that you're interested in need. And, you know, there's sometimes where we have people who want certain animals and they're not a good fit. We always try to point them to a different animal, and it's very rare that we decline people outright. Mm-hmm. But it's really all about matchmaking because we don't want the dog to come back either. And when you're adopting a dog, you want it to work out for you too. So that's really what it means to us, is being judgment-free and working with the person and trying to find a way to get to yes, while at the same time also making sure that the welfare of the animals is being the priority.
We've got some listeners, Sarah, who've been asking for your telephone number, so I'm going to give it out. It's 267-385-3800. Is that correct? Act Philly?
Yes, and I would add too that the website is actually we are short-staffed with hiring right now. We're hiring if anyone is looking, but yes, the website is the best way to get information.
ACTPhilly.org. That's ACCTPhilly.org. Understaffing, tell us about that.
Yeah, so we really are struggling a lot with the understaffing issue. We have multiple open positions right now. Animal care is one of the areas. We have 24 positions, and of those, we have 15 filled now. But people don't show up for interviews. They act very interested and then just don't show up, or they don't want to come to open houses. I got one response to an application saying, I'm not coming to the open house unless I'm guaranteed a job.
You're not the only employer, prospective employer.
Yes. Everyone is struggling with this. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. So say a person adopts an animal and they've already got animals in the home. What do you recommend to make sure that the adjustment process works?
I'm so glad you asked, because that's actually one of the biggest reasons we see animals come back. And we counsel adopters on this, but it's very rarely adhered to, which is decompression. It's so key, whether it's adopting from us or anyone. You have to keep those animals separate at first. They're coming from a very stressful environment into a new environment. So keep them separated, whether it's a dog and a dog or a cat and a cat. Keep them in a different room, and then do very slow introductions so that they really can adjust to them slowly. It's like you're being thrown from, if you're in the hospital and you get thrown in a frat party. You know, it's a very big adjustment. So give them some time to adjust, because that's probably the number one reason we see animals get returned, is because people say, they didn't get along with my dog. And we're like, well, you just brought them home yesterday.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. So it's something that's really important to do, is just very slow introductions, giving them space and making sure that you don't have, you know, friends come over with new dogs or anything like that, that you're really doing it very, very gradually.
You do need fosters. I know that there are fewer adopters and fosters, but you do need fosters. What does it take to be a successful foster aside from a big heart?
Really, I mean, that's the biggest part, is being willing to take in an animal. Right now, we're really looking for fosters for mother cats and nursing kittens. And for that, you just need a spare bathroom. And for medium and large sized dogs. And, you know, being willing to, you have to be responsive to people, you know, who are interested in adopting the dog. But really, other than that, you're just taking care of them. It's like temporary boarding almost, and then promoting them to people you know, which is easy. Because when you have an animal you love, you say, have you met Fluffy? Would you adopt Fluffy? So it's really easy and it's extremely rewarding, but it's something that we really are seeing people just don't have the time to do anymore. So we're really looking for anybody willing, and anybody who has questions can reach out to our foster team. We're always happy to talk through it.
And fostering is not meant as a test run.
No, it's not meant as a test run. That said, we know that sometimes you fall in love. So our
foster
policy,
fails.
Foster fail. Foster fail for us is sometimes a foster win. So we always tell people, if you end up wanting to adopt, that's totally fine. We actually waive the adoption fee. You just have to tell us the minute you decide that, because it's not fair to the public, obviously, if that dog is listed as available and you're wanting to adopt it.
Let's talk a little bit about dog breeds. In the South, shelters seem to have a lot of hounds. Up in the Northeast, a lot of pit bulls. There are a lot of misconceptions about pit bulls, who are a form of terrier. Can you dispel some of them?
They are amazing dogs. A lot of it is based on, you know, they are strong dogs. They are large dogs. And so part of it is, you know, there's these misconceptions about how they are around people. You know, most pit bulls are very nice around people. Sometimes they have issues with other dogs, but it's just like any other breed or type of dog where you really, it depends on the dog, you know? And so it's something that I think is so important for people to realize. I remember years ago, one of the highest bite rates of dog in a state was a golden retriever.
Really?
And I remember laughing, thinking, of course, because everyone's getting a golden retriever for their family because they look perfect, but you don't hear about those bites. So, yeah. And the other part I would say too is, pit bull is a type of dog. It's not necessarily a breed.
Right.
So that's something, too, where there's this assumption that, oh, that dog who did XYZ is a pit bull, where it's like you actually literally have no idea. 75% of shelter workers misidentify pit bulls in the shelter. It's why we actually label most of ours as mixed breed.
Yeah. So. If a listener can't adopt or foster at the moment but wants to help, what can they do?
Volunteer. If anybody is interested in volunteering, we are always looking for volunteers. We have both at the shelter, which is extremely helpful, but we are more and more trying to do offsite events again now that the pandemic is a little bit better, knock on wood. So looking for people to handle dogs at events, to help with, you know, we're going to be looking for offsite adoption centers, people who can help with that. So volunteering is huge. Donating makes a huge difference. You know, we are not able to provide these animals with offsite medical care if we don't have the supporters who make it possible. And even something as simple, honestly, as spreading the word. A lot of people don't even know we exist. ACT Philly is not a household name in Philly. So it's something where just posting on your social media saying, hey, ACT Philly has animals up for adoption. We have rabbits, we have cats, we have dogs, we have guinea pigs.
Not just dogs and cats. Yeah.
Exactly. We have pretty much everything. So just encouraging people to adopt, as well as look for their pet with us, because we want to make sure that if it's owned, it gets back to their owner.
Okay. Important to get the word out, because the next few months are usually the toughest for animal shelters.
Well, they're toughest for us at ACT. The summer is also always very difficult for ACT, for all shelters. But what we see at ACT this year is that our numbers are very much in line with what they were in 2019. And the worst months for us were August, September, October.
Why is that?
I mean, the summer is always very hard. You know, for us, it's probably also just that's, you know, they're going back to school. There's, you know, you've got that. People
change.
Going on vacation, all those changes happening. So there's a lot of that. There's also like rents. A lot of people, you know, it's kind of like the housing market and renting. So that's a big part of it too. But we were very fortunate in June. We just did our numbers for June in the first half of the year. We actually had a no-kill live release rate, which is amazing for dogs. It
Wonderful.
Certainly doesn't. It doesn't feel like that though, I will say.
Yeah.
But August, September, and October, we're expecting that to go down. It's very hard.
All right. Well, Sarah Burnett, thank you so much for all the work and other shelters that you and other shelters do for animals. We appreciate it.
Thank you
The
so
number
much.
For ACT Philly, 267-385-3800, if you want to help out. Better to visit the website, acctphilly.org, if you'd like to check in with them. We appreciate it. Sarah Burnett is Acting Co-Executive Director of the Animal Care and Control Team of Philadelphia. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
And remember, you can find today's show at whyy.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez is our engineer, our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day. Be well.